אז אני קצת, would like to continue a little bit. We talked a little bit about possibilities in meditation that would make meditation for us a bigger territory, and therefore finding ourselves in that territory more easily. And it's more difficult if we feel that there's one way and I'm either succeeding or I'm not succeeding. But the same is with the whole path. And you can ask, you know, what's the purpose of the path? What kind of path am I on? What is happening? What is pulling me? What is interesting for me? Well, you could also say, well, it has no purpose, and there is no path, and it doesn't, nothing really. I'm just there, and it's just life, and leave me alone. And they're, but they're fine. Both of those would be absolutely fine. So the whole path and the meditation and everything we do, in a way we can look at the purposes, or we can say there is no purpose and we can let it all go, and that's fine. But nevertheless, the wisdom is to keep understanding more deeply from more dimensions what it is we're doing. And so, one very clear dialogue in the tradition is around whether there is a path, and what is it, and or many, and how do I choose? In some way, we had it quite easy coming through the Vipassana tradition. Because the Vipassana tradition took one element of Dharma, of Buddhist teaching, and created quite a well-constructed model from this, which reached the 21st century quite well-constructed. And the model is very much basically path. There is Satipatthana, there is the four foundations, body, Vedana, Citta, and Dharma. There is discovery of the three characteristics, Anicca, and Anatta, and Dukkha. And it's really developed in huge texts. The Abhidharma text is huge, and Visuddhimagga is a kind of manual. So this leads to a very structured system in some way, Vipassana. It can be very structured, and Goenka is the most structured, in a way, of the Vipassana model, which says there is a certain way of doing things. And you do it this way. And Goenka takes it in a place which is unwise, which is that if you're not on that path, then you don't have it. And that's always the risk, that as soon as you have a path that you say, this is the path, you almost have to say all the other things are not on it, and are not right. It goes together, and it's very unfortunate. But it all the time, this is the issue. So, for example, when I sat a retreat with Thanat, who's a student of Ajahn Tong, and there was almost like a tavla, a table of called the 16 Yanot, and there are like experiences that you need to have, and they go one after another, 16 of them. And remember, this is only one page in the Abhidharma, which has thousands of pages of tables. And, but they, anyway, they took it as very strong. And I remember the Thanat had to do mamash acrobatics in order to fit my own experiences, which every day we report our experiences, to fit my experiences into the 16 Yanot. But he succeeded. Somehow. Everything, you know, never mind, my experiences were so different, but he kind of worked very hard and put them all in the table somewhere and said, yes, you know. And it was so funny to watch this effort to kind of put the, like I say, push the ocean, package the ocean into bottles. But the Vipassana also, thankfully, really does open up as well. And we are aligned with a much more open form of Vipassana, which is basically coming out of Achan Cha, of the Thai forest tradition, which leaves plenty of room. And it leaves plenty of room for the non-dual and the non-path. And it's quite true to the Buddha. To be honest, it's the to me, it's anyway personally, it's really close to the Buddha's teaching, because the Buddha did teach both path and no path. And if you look at some of the early teachings, I'll mention this in a minute, but they are very, very non-dual, and yet there's dualism there as well, and there's many, many paths. And so, you could say that that it's still that the Vipassana model is based on a model of purification, tihur. It does involve developing qualities that we bring into our life, qualities of joy and qualities of peace and qualities of concentration and steadiness and qualities of wisdom and kindness and ethics. And these are all kind of written into the system, but yet it is a path, meaning that, you know, the kindness is to overcome non-kindness, and the calm is to overcome non-calm, and the joy is to overcome fear. And so there, it is developmental. The Eightfold Path is a path, and it's very much part of the Vipassana tradition. And there is quite a strong movement of psychology in the Vipassana tradition, especially in the West, where we are really trying to rewrite our scripts, Lichtov Michadash, the Tasritim, the scripts, the narratives, the stories, to, we are, in a way, cleaning the stuff. And a lot of the Western language fits this, because the Western language has developed is a mind language, in a way, the way where the Western mind thinks is quite psychological, and so it kind of fits the Western mind. The early Buddhist teaching were very clearly both path and non-path. The Buddha again and again said, you know, start with morality, learn to behave, and this sense of inner purity will bring joy and peace, because as you protect yourself and you protect life and you have a kind attitude to life and you don't hurt yourself and you don't hurt life, then joy arises, and from joy inner calm arises, and from inner calm concentration and the jhanas arise, and from the jhanas insight arises, and vision, and from insight and vision, liberation happens. And there was quite a tradition, you could almost say, that the way in the monasteries was that people spent years, the monks spent years learning to behave, and learning how to act, and learning how to speak, and learning basic rules and so on, and from there arising simplicity and joy. And years and years and years, and at a certain moment the head of the monastery say, right, go to a cave. Finished. Go to a cave. And so, 1 year in the cave, finished. Liberated. Arhant. And that was the way it was done. It was done with Christopher like that. But at the same time, it's very clear that in the early tradition, the Buddha acknowledged that enlightenment is not, an awakening is not something that is related to path. It happens when it happens. It, you know, the story of Ananda, who wasn't an Arhant, and then the night before, the big night, he became an Arhant in the time it took for his head to fall onto the pillow when he was going to sleep. In that instant, as his head touching the pillow, so clearly something's happened, not in his control. He was trying for 10 years. What? He was trying to wake up, look at the sleep, yeah. So it clearly, you know, it's very much acknowledged it's not in our hands and it's something somewhere else, and therefore it doesn't really fit path. And there's so much in the Buddhist tradition that doesn't fit path at all, at all, at all. Zen is so much like Advaita in so many ways, in that the sense is that in the classic Zen tradition, the first thing you do is wake up, and then you try and hold it. And then you learn to deal with all the psychology. So you first wake up, and then you clean the stuff, which is a different view from we have in the Vipassana tradition, and maybe in the Western tradition. First of all, you need to go to a psychologist for 10 years. When you're settled, and then you go to meditate. When you meditate for 10 years, then you kind of awaken. And you write books about it. but Zen is different. They really try and kind of let it happen by very strong practice right now, right at the beginning. And then the trouble is trying to hold it against all the forces of samsara that brings you back. Dzogchen, very similar. The first you go to a teacher and you get the view. The view is the awakened view. Like, there's a point of view. Point of view from above, point of view from below. Vipassana would say, go up the hill. Dzogchen would say, start at the top. How? Your teacher slaps you on the back. Bah! And the view arises. And from the view, it's a bit like Zen. You practice meditation in order to maintain the view. And it's really a bit like where you start and where you are. The image I like is the white paper and the writing on the paper. The writing on the paper maybe is the writing of our life, our story, how we are formed, shape of this life here. That's the narrative, where I was born, who I am, what I think, what my experiences are, suffering, happiness, everything. The white page is the ground, is like being, formless. On there is the writing. So where do we start with our practice? We start with the white page. We start with the narratives, trying to clean them up. Truth is, we do both. And a wise tradition, I think, the Buddha in that sense was very wise and said, do both. Don't forget the white page. But yes, we have stuff and we don't want to be under illusion. And so gradually, we develop the white page and we leave clinging to the narratives, the writing on the page. We just let it get, to push the metaphor a bit more, you could say we whiten the writing by non-attachment. And so we whiten. Lavan. Malbinim et aktiva. She'az basof ha'aktiva v'ha'lavan ze oto davar ha'daf ha'lavan v'ha'aktiva in hevdel. So you could say, but slowly, slowly they come together. But we generally do. In the Vipassana tradition, we do work on both. But in the strong method, then the white page is kind of forgotten. The Buddhist tradition is very, is very wise about this. And even in the most sort of classic Buddhist teachings, you'll find, like in Nagarjuna, who says that, you know, nirvana and samsara are the two sides of the same coin. There isn't really the white page and the writing is illusion in a way. There isn't, who says there's difference? And in the bigness, maybe it's just the way we look at things that separate nirvana and samsara, difficulty, conditioned, or form and emptiness. What's the Heart Sutra? Emptiness is form and nothing other than form. And form is emptiness. And the same with the Vedana, and the same with perception, and the same with consciousness. Consciousness is not other than emptiness. Emptiness is not other than consciousness. So it kind of puts things together. I also think that in the emphasis on the Dharma to letting go, to not being, not clinging, to, which is really the number one teaching of the Buddha Dharma, which is that nothing is worth holding on to. That's the number one teaching. Like, no Buddhist is going to dispute that, from wherever they come from, whoever they are, whichever part of the world they come from. Every Buddhist anywhere will say the fundamental instruction is non-clinging, not holding on, letting go. And in there is, it's also non-dual. It's also the white page. Because, you know, the most classic sutta about this is the sutta of Anathapindika, or one of the classic suttas. And he was nearly dying. And he was on his way to die. And the monks came to him and said, I'll give you the teaching, you know, the ultimate teaching. And then they just went through the whole of human existence and said, you know, don't cling to this, don't cling to this, don't cling to this, don't hold on to perception, don't hold on to what you hear or see, don't hold on to a thought, don't hold on to body, don't hold on to feelings, don't hold, everything is like dropping. So in that place, you know, we're back to the white page. It's so radical and so total, the non-clinging, that when there's no holding on, then there's nowhere to go. There's just nothing left. So you're back to the white page. Even though it's the first, the Four Noble Truths, and it's clinging is a kind of a process, and non-clinging seems to be a process, but in the end, it's also white page. So, in our attitude, how does this affect our practice? And I think we can again, I want to do a little bit of what the same I did this morning. This morning I talked about meditation, now I want to a little bit talk about the whole of our practice life. And I think that we can feel where we feel interested and comfortable. Where is the interest for us? This is an important question. This is the question I was going to ask you in the middle of the meditation just now, which I ended up silent. So I threw a silent question. What is interesting for you, for me? Where's the juice? And the juice can be the white page, or the juice can be halbana, is it? Whitening up our narratives, our stories. Letting them go, seeing them pass, seeing them as not anything, seeing them as just air. We can feel that the juice for us is more spiritual, and we're dealing with psychology later. Right now, I'm going for the top of the mountain, and afterwards I'll clean up stuff. Yeah, fine. I'll deal with my psychology later. Or somebody else will deal with it. My family, my wife, my this, my husband, my... Or we can do the opposite. I need to deal with my content, with the writing on the page. This is giving me pain. I need to deal with it. I'm not going to be in the white page story. I'm not going to be in the spiritual dimension and leave the mess. First clean the mess. As Krishnamurti keeps saying, first put your house in order. First clean the mess. And then, when that's right, when you feel clear, then go for it. Now both of those ways have problems. For example, if you go for the spiritual and say, and leave the mess, then you're in the territory of spiritual bypass. I think it's here. You're in the territory of spiritual bypass, meaning that you rush ahead spiritually and painfully ignore difficulties and suffering, and they trip you up. They're like a kind of a makel in the wheel of a bicycle. And they don't let you progress. And so spiritual bypass is a danger of the first choice, going to, you know, climbing too high and avoid as a kind of escape from suffering. And the other is another form, a danger of the other side, which is spending all your life cleaning. And working on your stuff, and the danger of that is that you're really busy with trying to be better. And you're stuck with the problem of becoming bhava in Sanskrit. Busy trying to be a better person, which is fine up to a point, but if that's your place, then you're always in this story of trying to kind of correct something, and it's an assumption there that you're no good to begin with, and you have to keep correcting things and fixing things. And fixing things brings you into a territory of I'm no good and I need to be fixed. So you're circling around that territory all the time. So that's the danger. And just to be aware of the risks and the danger. I think that it's wise for us to feel our personality, to feel what are our strengths, and go with our strengths, and go with our interest. And where we have our choosing our path, we go with what's interesting for us. And I think it's not clear what's interesting. You can't say for anybody what will be interesting. It's a lot of it is karma. Something just arises in our life and says, that's interesting. I want to go there. And it can be a teacher. It can be a sentence, a mishpat. It can be a thought. It can be a book we read. It can be some sort of direction that we have in life. It can be understanding of our strengths, where we are powerful. And here, the seven factors are a good guide. We can look at the seven factors and say, which ones of those really talks to me? Do I feel easy?
What's the seven factors?
Calm, joy, and rapture, concentration, mindfulness, kindness. Can't remember them all. Investigation. Wisdom. I think that's more or less. So we can go with our strength. And sometimes we want to go against our weakness. We say, I need effort on this. It's really holding me back. So that becomes our interest. So for example, we may find that our weakness, if you like, could be fear. or insecurity. We feel we're not, I don't have the courage. We feel insecure, not confident. So we say, look, that's hanging me up. That's pulling me down. I need to go there. And I also, of course, if I work with that, life will be easier for me. So 100% legitimate. Go there, even though it's difficult. Go and work with it. Use a retreat to work with it or be interested in it. So it's very much to do with understanding who we are and what is interesting for us, what arises naturally as path and where we feel at home, which kind of practice, because there's thousands and different ways up the mountain. They all lead to the same place, by the way. But we have many, many paths up the mountain, and mostly we make our own path. There really isn't a path that's totally constructed for us. We really have to cut our own path up the mountain. And if we feel confusion and paradox around path and around all of this, and uncertainty, and even this talk, if your inner response is, oh, it's all too much for me, I don't know what he's talking about, I can't understand where I'm at, I don't know where I'm at, leave me alone with all of this, I'm a, as Winnie the Pooh said, I'm a poo of little brain. So, leave me alone. It's fair enough. I mean, you know, that's okay. Confusion and paradox is part of the story. It's almost like a necessary part of the story. Because if we think we know where we are illusion. And that needs a whole nother Dharma talk if I'm going to go into that, why that is. But it's about the limits of thought. So if we feel, you know, confused and the paradox, there's too many choices or it's okay to say, yeah, but what interests me? And what's easy for me? And what do I enjoy? And what feels right? And I'm independent, autonomous, and I'll take the teaching the way I feel. And I will climb and cut my own path up the mountain. And if, with the confusion, it's all right. Confusion is not a problem. You know, one of the milestones of awakening is the stream enterer. It's called stream entry. I don't know if you've heard of this. But stream entry is defined. And one of the places it's defined is not believing in packages, rituals or practices or given promises or, you know, paths, not believing. Being independent of belief that if I do this, then I'll get that. That's one of the signs. It's like you've finished with that. You don't, not interested anymore. You're independent. Discussion last time we met, the importance of independence. And that's, the stream enterer is one of the signs. The other three signs are not believing anymore or not believing in the self. Doesn't mean to say being totally non-self, but it means just leaving the belief in self. And the third is reducing desire. And the fourth, do I remember?
I think it's doubt.
Could be, yeah. Yeah, could be doubt. Yeah. Yeah, probably. So it's worth remembering that confusion arises and paradox arises because our path, in a way, is made by thinking and is about beyond thinking. We read a book or we listen to a talk like this, or we talk to each other, we're in the world of thought and understanding. But the teaching isn't there. We can't go stay in the territory of thought. So the by definition, our spiritual awareness, our awakenings, are beyond thought. They're not in the territory of thinking. Thinking is in the brain, it's here, it's limited, but insight and wisdom takes us beyond thought. So path is within thought, and it needs to jump us beyond thought. And there is a place of confusion, where the thought tries to go beyond itself. And confusion there is healthy. It's a good sign, it's something helpful. It's saying, okay, I don't know what's going on, but let it take me. I'm ready for what happens. And so all the time we are invited to be on path and drop things and drop path. Be on path, but let go clinging. The Buddha said, be on a path, but then my teaching also is just a raft, rough soda. Let it go. When we cross the other side of the river, you don't need a raft anymore. And in the small ways, keep dropping things, keep dropping our seriousness, keep dropping our beliefs, keep dropping our sense that there is a path. In some way, the path kills itself. Every time we have a path, it actually undoes itself. There can't be a path in this moment, right now, of timeless existence. There cannot be any path anymore. In existence itself, there is no path. There is no time. We are, in a way, constructing ourselves a path in order to undo the path. In order to let go of the path. So we're almost tricking the mind. So that the mind can say, oh, okay, I know what I'm doing. Oh, I'm fine. I'm going on a path. They're very nice, you know. It's very good, very good. Can dress in nice Indian clothes and feel good and go on my spiritual journey to Tiruvannamalai. But it's all, in a way, a construction in order to deconstruct. It's just to make the mind comfortable in order to, while we're in the process of deconstructing. So, and everything is fine. To be on the path is fine. As long as we allow space for the white page, as long as we allow space while we're on path, while we're practicing, while we are having intention, while we come to a weekend where we learn together things, everything is fine. As long as we leave space for unknown reality to touch us in ways that we can't control. So as long as we leave space for the unknown, space for the unexpected, just leave room for that, those voices that we don't know where they're coming from. We don't know what they are. We don't know how to, they're not in control. And as we get further and further up the mountain, those voices and those places become more and more and more. And we just need to leave space for them. Someone made an image of, that I read of, the journey is a bit like, you know, under the sea, there is the continental shelf. It means that the land mass, and it goes like that, like that, like that, and suddenly, boom. There's no more. And it's the bottomless ocean 3 miles down. But the land, you know, you can go down, 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 bah, finished. And it's, So I think, you know, we have to allow that to sort of those drops to happen, those places where there's no real ground, where it's not in our hands, really. It's not in not in time. It's not in and that's all we can do, and that's fine. And so we be good children and do our practice and leave space for the unexpected, the unknown, the reality mamashut to happen to us. And just, you know, it's like when I asked Ajahn Amaro many years ago, actually, why are you still in robes? Why are you still a monk? You don't need robes. The Buddha didn't, you know, say you need robes for awakening. Actually, the Buddha did say you need robes for awakening. But I asked him directly. He said only robes. He didn't say you need the he didn't say the robes were the awakening. He said only robes, not nothing else. He said, well, it's just, this is the way I am, and this is my form, and this is how I come towards the, how I face the unknown, with these clothes, and why not? It's kind of, it's a good answer. It's just, we do our path, yes, because we do need to trick the mind, but we leave plenty of space. So, in some way or other, to the dialogue between path and pathless is with us all the time in different ways. You can look at it in another way, which I mentioned at the beginning, and this is the preparation for Yisrael this evening. You can say, you can come to things from the above view, the view of above, which is very much like I said, the Dzogchen master will give the view to the student right at the beginning. The view from above. And the view from above, in a sense, doesn't leave you a lot to do. So, it's often taught by satsang, by words, by giving a view, by a teacher giving a view. But it, as I say, you can't just be there, because it can lead to loads and loads of illusion, which is that you're thinking yourself awakened, and actually you're still in thought. And very often you can get into illusion that suffering doesn't exist, or that the right ethics are not necessary, and so on. You can get into lots of illusion there if you take it too far. But there is a point in it, the view from above. And the view from below is about nourishing, hazana, to nourish the ground, to nourish the, give food to the base, to the ground of our being. And from there, just allowing the fruit, the plants to grow. And there's a dialogue between these two in our life. And I think that it's a very interesting place, this dialogue. And may you have plenty of interesting times with it.